At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Counting down to New Year's? It's not just party time, you know. The Affordable Care Act goes into effect, the government takes on a few small projects, and we say a few tearful and not so tearful goodbyes. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Investing, renting, sending your kid to college? Listen to the Marketplace Money Podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From APM in New York, I'm Lizzie O'Leary in for Kai Rizdahl, and this is your Marketplace Podcast for Tuesday, the 31st of December, New Year's Eve. It is good to have you with us, and we're starting with healthcare. We've got new numbers from the Obama administration today saying 2 million people have signed up for coverage on the Affordable Care Act's health exchanges. Tomorrow, January 1st, marks not only the new year, but also the first day of coverage under the ACA. Anybody who's been watching the law roll out knows the next few months in healthcare could be filled with confusion. Much of that at the doctor's office. From the health desk at WHYY in Philadelphia, Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein reports.
On the eve of the Affordable Care Act's full launch, different scenarios are running through Dr. Cheryl Bettegol's head, like someone with a new plan coming in on Thursday with a hernia that needs immediate attention.
Okay, we can give you a surgery referral. Who takes your insurance? You know, that book that's going to arrive in the mail sometime and tell us the whole list of specialists, we don't have that yet.
Referrals are one thing, but Bettegol says she's not sure how much her doctors will get paid under the new exchange plans.
If we end up with very low reimbursements for patients with these exchange plans, you know, could that impact our ability to stay open or to provide services?
My estimate is that things are going to be good, that this is going to work, and that we will not have a breakdown of the medical system.
That's Dr. Charles Cutler, an internist in suburban Philadelphia, who also chairs the board of the American College of Physicians. Over his 30 years in practice, Cutler has seen patients routinely turn down treatment, more concerned about cost than their own health. Things under the Affordable Care Act, he hopes, will be different.
We're suddenly covering preventive care, a screening we're covering. So people will have an opportunity to be diagnosed earlier.
Cutler says there will be mistakes, like patients leaving his office with prescriptions not covered by their new insurance plans. But he says that happens right now. The protections for patients that are new, he says, that's worth the headaches down the road. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
A freight train carrying crude oil derailed and exploded in North Dakota yesterday. 20 cars caught on fire, sending smoke into the sky. Explosions shook homes and businesses for hours. There were no injuries, but residents were told to evacuate their homes. The derailment is likely to renew the debate about how safe it is to use rail lines to move oil. Marketplace's Adrian Hill reports.
In July, a train carrying oil exploded in Canada, killing 47 people. Last month in Alabama, an oil-carrying train caught fire when it derailed. And now, another explosion in North Dakota. Sandy Fielden is an energy analyst at RBN Energy.
This is just one in a string of legitimate concerns about the movement of crude oil by rail.
Depending on the investigation, he says, there may be pressure to make some regulatory changes. But don't expect anything too dramatic. North Dakota is the second largest oil-producing state. By some estimates, trains will move 90% of North Dakota's crude next year.
There's no question. This oil is going to get to the market.
Robert Bryce is with the conservative Manhattan Institute. He supports the Keystone Pipeline project as an alternative to moving oil by train. But he says it's going to get to market one way or another. It's too early to know exactly what happened in North Dakota. There are questions about the tracks, the trains, the tankers that were moving the oil. Holly Arthur is with the Association of American Railroads. Rail, she says, has been used to move crude oil since the early days of the industry. Things have picked up dramatically since 2009 and the rise of fracking.
Today, 99.997% of all hazmat moved by rail reaches its destination without a release caused by an accident.
A reassuring number, but people who live along these lines know there are also more trains hauling oil. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, oh, so much happy music. Stocks closed out their best year of at least the last 15. We'll have details when we do the numbers. It may not feel like it, but prices are low, at least for commodities. Gold prices are their lowest in 30 decades. Corn prices are down 40%. Coffee, down 20%. We asked Marketplace's Mark Garrison to explain what's going on.
Corn and coffee prices are down largely because there's a lot more corn and coffee in the world. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace. I'm kidding, of course. We've got 90 seconds, so let's try a different question, perhaps one you've pondered while buying your favorite cereal or a pricey drink at Starbucks. If commodities prices are dropping for companies, how come we're still paying basically the same price in stores?
People don't eat commodities. What they do is they eat food.
Iowa State University economist Bruce Babcock points to all the other expenses that go into making food, from transportation to manufacturing to marketing. Professionally, he thinks a lot about corn prices, but personally, coffee.
I do know I'm spending $14 a pound on Pete's coffee, and that bears no reflection whatsoever to the price of Arabica beans down in Brazil.
Duke University finance professor Campbell Harvey says some brands are strong enough that they don't have to pass the savings on to you.
The raw commodity, which is coffee, is going down. So your costs are going down. Your revenues are staying about the same, which means your profitability is going to go up.
Food prices may come down for shoppers, but probably not for a while. And it's not just edible commodities. Metals are dropping too, with always volatile gold in a free fall. Then there's copper. Paul Christopher at Wells Fargo Advisors says it's lower because China's growth is slower.
They're going to be pulling back a little bit on some of the spending they've been doing to build factories and homes. That's going to reduce their demand for copper.
And consequently, its price. I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
Peace talks could end the fighting in South Sudan. Both sides, the government and the rebels who support the former vice president, have agreed to talks in Ethiopia. Still, fighting is continuing in the world's youngest country and in the key town of Bor. James Copnell was the BBC's Sudan and South Sudan correspondent, and he's now writing a book about the region. We reached him in Juba, South Sudan. Thank you for taking the time.
Thank you very much for having me.
Can you give me a sense of what the situation in Bor is right now?
Well, the first thing to say is that Bor is a very strategic town. It's one of the capitals of the 10 states of South Sudan. It's just to the north of the national capital, Juba. And it was taken by the rebels and regained by the government. And it now, one minister did tell me that he believed Bor had fallen to the rebels, but I will say that it does seem to be a pretty fluid military situation.
Help us understand why South Sudan matters in the global economic scale. This is the world's newest country. It's also one with oil, and yet one the U.S. uses as sort of a buffer between itself and Sudan.
Yes, I mean, oil is vital for the South Sudanese economy. It represents about 98% of the government's revenue, a truly astonishing amount. And actually, China imports quite a bit of oil from South Sudan. So the Chinese have every incentive to see a peaceful and stable South Sudan because with this conflict and with the rebels controlling some of the oil fields, there's serious doubts about whether that oil will keep flowing. And it's important regionally too, clearly. the region is watching what's happening very, very closely, and I think so too is the wider world.
The U.S. has sent a special envoy, Donald Booth, to South Sudan. Can you help frame for us what the U.S. wants here, what the U.S. interest is?
Well, my sense is that that actually it would have been difficult for South Sudan to become an independent country without America's influence. And certainly it's seen that way here too, even though, of course, it was the South Sudanese who died in the long wars and fought for their freedom as they saw it. So America, I think, has a historic interest in South Sudan. And there's been American aid, lots of money pledged over a 3 or 4 year period. And that, I think, many people here feel gives America not just leverage, but also some sort of responsibility for trying to push the South Sudanese leaders to make wise decisions in this very difficult time.
James Copnell, Africa analyst for the BBC, speaking to me from Juba. Thank you so much for talking with me.
Thank you very much.
Coming up, orange farmers in Florida are trying all sorts of cures and spending thousands of dollars to save their trees from disease.
For us and the rest of our family, it's been our life's work, and yes, it is worth it.
But first, let's do the numbers. The markets ended a big year on an up note. The Dow Jones Industrial Average added on 72 points. That's 0.4% to close at 16,576. The NASDAQ rose 22 points, more than 0.5%. Ending at 41.76, the S&P put on 7 points, or 0.4%, to close at 18.48. For the year, the Dow rose more than 26%, its best since 1995. The S&P 500 climbed 29%, biggest yearly jump since 97. And the NASDAQ shot up 38%, the best since 09. Twitter bounced back nearly 5% after a couple of rough days of trading. Over in Europe, markets were mixed. The German DAX deleted 0.4%. The French CAC 40 added 0.4%. And London's FTSE picked up 0.25%. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.02%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf. Online at marketplace.org/thebigbook.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Wednesday. Did you resolve to get rid of that sea of clutter on your desk? Strike while the iron is hot. January is Get Organized Month, so says the National Association of Professional Organizers. Not ready to tackle that? The National Soup Month may be more your speed. Loving me some tomato. No, corn chowder. Can't decide. And bazillions of New Year's resolutions go into effect. I don't know about yours, but my gym is actually open tomorrow. I'm Michelle Philippi.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, in for Kai Rizdahl. This week, we've been asking our correspondents to think about the areas they cover and look ahead to the new year. Not a year-end list of stories, but a year-beginning one. And today, we're talking with our Washington correspondent, David Gura. Hey, David.
Hey, Lizzie.
All right, so the year ends with, oh my gosh, an actual budget deal. First time in 30 years. So look ahead. What's next? What comes after that?
Well, we shouldn't downplay the significance of the fact that Congress actually did something. I mean, that is an achievement unto itself. But this was not a big deal or a grand bargain, as politicians like to say. This was a really basic compromise, Lizzie. But I think that this is going to be the model kind of going forward into 2014, that politicians are going to scale back their ambitions. And I know that New Year's is supposed to be the time for wild optimism about what's to come. But I think that politicians are not going to aim that high next year. I think they're going to take this sort of piecemeal approach to things that aren't related to the budget. So maybe immigration and tax reform, things like that.
So explain how that framework works for all of these other issues.
Yeah, I started thinking about this when that bipartisan budget conference committee started meeting. Paul Ryan, at that first meeting, said the taxes were not going to be on the table. And he held really firm to that. And for their part, Democrats did the same thing. And so what they came up with was this agreement that really at its face was pretty underwhelming. I mean, here is Patty Murray just announcing that compromise.
So this deal doesn't solve all of our problems, but I think it is an important step in helping to heal some of the wounds here in Congress, to rebuild some trust and show that we can do something without a crisis right around the corner.
Okay, so maybe as Congress licks its wounds, I can get a slow clap from you, Lizzie, for that. But I don't think that this small act of bipartisanship, doing the bare minimum, is going to lead to big changes on other issues, at least not in these next few months.
Okay, so look ahead for me. What are the other issues we're talking about here?
Yeah, so, I mean, first up is the debt ceiling. So here we go again with the debt ceiling. And, you know, this is really kind of the quintessential modest bargain that we've seen brokered over and over again. So there's this kind of quasi-compromise for a deal that's going to raise the debt ceiling for, what, a couple of months, maybe half a year? And just because of the way that's played out over and over again, because of the political climate here, I don't think that's going to change. I don't think we're going to get to a point where this isn't something that we're going to have to keep worrying about every few months, every half year or so.
The only other one that's out there that people of both parties like to talk big about here is tax reform. But that's a really big lift. You think that falls back into the small plates course?
I do. And I mean, it's a big lift just in terms of how thick and thorny the tax policy. I mean, it's like tens of thousands of pages long. So, you know, maybe in the end, Congress will close a few loopholes or they'll do away with some deductions and tax credits. But I'm not really sure that you could say changing a few things here and there constitutes real tax reform.
That's your look ahead for the year. Small plates, small ball, a lot of little compromises. That's going to be on your beat for the year, David Gura.
Lucky me.
Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thanks, Lizzie.
Staying on taxes, the gas tax funds the upkeep of our roads and bridges. These days, we're paying less, though, in federal fuel taxes. Part of it is that the federal gas tax hasn't gone up in a while. The other part is that more people are driving fuel-efficient cars, which means they're buying less gas altogether. Marketplace's Quina Kim reports on a possible tax fix.
How do you replace a tax loss? With a new tax on hybrids, electric cars, and bikes. Douglas Schinkel is a policy expert at the National Conference of State Legislatures. He says those vehicles aren't the only ones to blame for the fall in fuel taxes. He says Americans are just driving less.
Since about 2001, the amount of vehicle miles traveled per American has gone down for every age group, and particularly for millennials.
Schinkel says at the same time, all cars are getting more fuel efficient. That means everyone is paying less in fuel taxes, and so states and cities need to find ways to make up for that shortfall.
Chicago is certainly one of those cities that's struggling to pay the bills.
Jim Merrill is with the Active Transportation Alliance in Chicago, which advocates for bikers and walkers. A councilwoman in that city recently floated the idea of levying a $25 fee on bikers, in part to pay for their use of the road. Merrill says in Chicago, fuel taxes pay for less than half the cost of maintaining roads. The rest of the money comes from the general fund. And he notes, most bikers drive too. Jay Friedland is with Plug in America, which advocates for electric cars. He says increasingly states are imposing fees on electric cars and hybrids.
We've already seen Virginia and Washington state pass laws. There's laws under consideration in New Jersey, North Carolina, Indiana.
And come January 1st, electric car owners in Colorado will have to pay a $50 a year fee. In San Francisco, I'm Quina Kim for Marketplace.
We're nearing the end of orange harvesting season in Florida right now. The state produces almost all of the orange juice we drink in this country, about a half billion gallons a year. But a virulent disease is attacking Florida's citrus groves. It's pushed many farmers to leave the business or sell off their groves. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith looks at two farms that are sticking with citrus and how they're making it work.
Good morning. We're going to call the meeting to order. We got a long day ahead of us.
In Bartow, Florida, the Florida Department of Citrus is meeting to talk business and budgets.
We rise for the invocation of the Pledge of Allegiance from Pastor Rick.
The mood is somber. For most of the past decade, Florida's $9 billion citrus industry has been hammered by a disease called greening. Florida's now producing half the oranges it used to. Greening-infected trees stop being able to move nutrients from leaf to root. They starve to death over several years. As they decline, their leaves turn yellow, and they start to produce small, misshapen fruit.
Here you can see this fruit. It's not any bigger than a golf ball, and there's just thousands and thousands of them.
Quentin Rowe and his brother William run one of the largest tangerine operations in the country in Winter Haven, Florida. They can't sell the undersized fruit, so that gets taken to their juicing plant.
And it essentially sucks all the juice out of the fruit.
William Rowe stands in front of a line of stainless steel extractors that produce tens of thousands of gallons of juice a day. Size doesn't matter for fruit that's juiced, but taste does. And Rowe says greening affects that too.
We aren't developing the bricks in the fruit that we used to develop. It doesn't taste as sweet, doesn't taste as balanced.
As they watched their product quality decline along with their profits, the Rowe brothers took action.
This is the culmination of literally millions and millions of dollars.
At their prototype grove in Winter Haven, Florida, Quentin Rowe inspects rows of hip-high tangerine trees wrapped in white plastic tubing. These are special, fast-growing trees, planted close together and sprayed frequently. The rows yank out anything that looks infected and scout regularly for signs of greening. They say they've been able to keep the disease out of these groves. And that, says Quentin, is the industry's only hope.
In the next 5 to 8 years, all the tangerine groves in the state of Florida, as we know them right now, will be dead or non-productive.
The Rowe system has pushed the cost of caring for trees from $1,200 an acre to more than $3,000. They hope the costs will be offset by the premium customers will be willing to pay for full-sized sweet fruit.
Yeah, my name is Moy Boyd. I've been called a Typhoid Moy, too.
While the Rowes are spending millions of dollars to keep greening out, there's another school of thought among Florida's farmers, living with the disease. Maury Boyd has become something of a celebrity in the Florida citrus community. When greening first hit Florida, the state asked farmers to destroy infected trees. Boyd refused.
So let's walk on into the tree rows now.
There are signs of greening all over Boyd's Valencia Grove, but the trees are heavy with baseball-sized oranges.
We've got very good yields. It's somewhat amazing.
Boyd started experimenting and eventually developed something now known as the Boyd technique. It involves showering trees with food and nutrients, literally.
We got a high-blast sprayer blowing all these nutrients, and it's coming out 90 miles an hour. It's kind of like eating 6 meals a day instead of 3 meals a day. Got it? Okay.
Boyd says if you care for the trees properly, they can live with greening. But it isn't cheap. Just like the Rowes, Boyd's costs have tripled. He's able to make a profit because the price of oranges has gone up as the supply has declined.
We're surviving it, doing all right.
Dr. Harold Browning is a botanist who has helped Florida citrus farmers battle diseases like canker and blight. He says greening is like nothing he's ever seen. And although he says it's good to see farmers innovating, he worries none of these solutions are economically viable in the long term.
There is no economical, sustainable, durable kind of management system. So we're kind of building that on the fly.
Browning says the rising price of Florida citrus has consumers backing away. We're drinking 20% less orange juice than we used to. Browning thinks the only solution is a cure. But after 8 years battling the disease, there's nothing in sight.
You know, you look at Bill and I in our late 50s, mid to late 50s, haha.
Quentin Rowe says his grandfather started this business, and he and William are passing it on to their children. Bouncing through their groves at dusk in a work truck, Quentin and William say it's about more than economics.
For us and the rest of our family, it's been our life's work, and yes, it is worth it.
In Winter Haven, Florida, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
You want to see what greening looks like up close? We've got a slideshow of Stacy's trip, plus some cool orange juice facts at marketplace.org. Close of today's broadcast, our last for the year, and for this, our final Marketplace story of 2013, we thought we would share with you some of the things we lost this year. And we lost some great ones in the business world. Marketplace's David Weinberg brings us this teary goodbye to some of the people, products, and businesses that will not be joining us in 2014.
It's that time of year when we mourn the loss of those who are no longer with us. Like the limited edition Watermelon Oreo, a product that expired before it even had a chance to really live, or the Hobbit-themed menu at Denny's. This year, we also bid a heart-wrenching farewell to airline competition. The merger of U.S. Airways and American Airlines gave us the largest airline company ever created, New American.
The New American is arriving.
And we said goodbye to another New American, Walter White.
No matter how it may look, I only had you in my heart. Goodbye.
Breaking Bad was monumental in the TV business. It resurrected the career of Vince Gillian, brought big financial rewards to AMC, gave birth to the spinoff Better Call Saul, and a string of new anti-hero shows. America also began its slow goodbye to financial stimulus and hello to the taper when Ben Bernanke made this announcement.
And we expect that growth will pick up somewhat in coming quarters, helped by highly accommodative monetary policy.
The tapering announcement helped stabilize markets and gave birth to the new spinoff Better Call Bernanke. But perhaps the most dramatic goodbye of 2013 was the farewell speech made by Microsoft CEO Steve Ballmer.
Microsoft's like a fourth child to me.
He made the speech in Seattle's Key Arena to thousands of Microsoft employees, and he chose to end with a song.
A song that looked back retrospectively, and a song that celebrated the future.
And so, with tears streaming, the CEO of one of America's most influential companies made his exit, jumping up and down and high-fiving employees to the theme from Dirty Dancing. I'm David Weinberg for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note, I'm here in New York, across town from Times Square, where the ball will be dropped at midnight. But Americans are an imaginative sort. Far be it for us to be confined to lowering spherical objects to celebrate the new year. Eastport, Maine will drop a giant fake sardine. Boise, Idaho, a $10,000 foam potato. Brasstown, North Carolina will lower a live and controversial possum. And Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, a 75-pound light-up candy peep. I want to party with you guys. Our thanks to the Atlantic Wire, which compiled the long and ridiculous list. All right, that's it. That's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow added 72 points, 0.4%. The NASDAQ rose 22 points, more than 0.5%. The S&P put on 7 points, 0.4%. Nancy Fargali and John Ketchum are producers on our Marketplace desks. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Have a safe new year. This is 8 p.m.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.